There's a particular kind of nausea that comes from looking in the mirror and despising what you see. Fresh out of Harvard Business School with an Oxford economics degree, I found myself at D.H. Blair Investment Banking, a firm later shut down amid 173 counts of stock fraud. My job? Dress up dubious deals while aggressive brokers in the boiler room sold them to unsuspecting investors. My Ivy League credentials provided a respectable veneer for operations that would eventually result in executives pleading guilty and paying $21 million to defrauded customers. How does someone supposedly intelligent end up in such a morally bankrupt place? The answer reveals something uncomfortable about elite education and human nature. We like to think credentials protect us from poor judgment, but they often do the opposite, creating overconfidence that blinds us to obvious red flags. My arrogance made me ignore warnings, convinced I was too smart to be fooled. This catastrophic choice became my greatest teacher, forcing me to confront a truth that would reshape everything. Our environment changes us far more than we change it. Elite education can be a liability disguised as an advantage. Many architects of the 2008 financial crisis held prestigious degrees. My Oxford training taught me to accept complex theories without questioning their validity, like the efficient markets hypothesis, which claims stock prices reflect all available information. It took a decade to recognize this as fundamentally wrong. Elite schools produce minds like Formula One Ferraris, magnificent on smooth racetracks, useless on rough terrain. The real world demands hardy Jeeps. My most influential investing mentor never attended Oxford or Harvard. Warren Buffett, rejected by Harvard Business School, cared nothing about pedigrees. This realization was liberating. Perhaps my expensive education had narrowed rather than expanded my thinking. After D.H. Blair, Wall Street rejected me. Goldman Sachs suspected I was either too stupid to spot corruption or complicit in it. My inner voice insisted, "You'll never have a successful career in finance." My breakthrough came from Tony Robbins. Despite dismissing him as a crass American, I attended his seminar following a principle: whenever something offers uncertain but potentially high upside, try it. The seminar culminated in walking across red-hot embers, a powerful metaphor for breaking through self-imposed limitations. Robin's message hit hard. When stuck, just make a move. This was exactly what Oxford never taught. I devoured previously dismissed self-help books, Dale Carnegie, Napoleon Hill, finding practical wisdom about human nature my formal education lacked. I joined investment societies, screened for undervalued stocks, visited Burlington Coat Factory stores with genuine excitement about owning a piece of a real business. I discovered an ecosystem of value investors who operated with integrity, the complete opposite of D.H. Blair. At 30, managing $50 million, I outperformed for 5 years and dodged the tech bubble. When Wall Street noticed, peer envy triggered ego-driven mistakes. Expensive Carnegie Hall Tower offices, unnecessary staff, costly Bloomberg terminals, all disconnected from investment logic. My smartest move was forming the Posse, a mastermind group meeting weekly to debate ideas. They saved me from disaster with Farmer Mac, which I'd pitched as an undiscovered gem like Freddie Mac. One member's annotated filings revealed far greater risks. I sold immediately. But I regret getting carried away shorting and publicly criticizing the company, which drew me into a stressful regulatory probe. The lesson? Surround yourself with people smarter than you, but know your temperament. Conflict didn't align with my nature. Writing 15 weekly thank you letters transformed me unexpectedly. As I expressed gratitude, I genuinely felt more thankful and opened myself to others. Paradoxically, abandoning my self-serving agenda made people more interested in my fund. Through this practice, I met Monish Pabrai at his unconventional annual meeting. I sent a simple thank you note, expecting nothing. 6 months later, he invited me to dinner, which altered my trajectory more than meeting Buffett himself. Over breakfast, Monish proposed we jointly bid for a charity lunch with Buffett. His analysis convinced me. The money would support a worthy cause while meeting our role model. We won with a $650,100 bid. Before the lunch, uncomfortable about my hedge fund's fees, I created a new share class mirroring Buffett's original partnerships. No management fee, only 25% of profits after investors earned 6% annually. When I confessed this change so Buffett wouldn't think me greedy, he responded with unforgettable wisdom. People will always stop you doing the right thing if it's unconventional. The 2008 financial crisis revealed I needed structural advantages, not willpower. Following Buffett and Prabhai's example, I relocated from New York to Zurich and redesigned my workspace. I positioned a bronze bust of Charlie Munger as a reminder of cognitive biases and displayed photographs from our lunch with Warren as visual cues. Buffett's Omaha office exemplified deliberate simplicity: two chairs preventing unnecessary meetings, closed shades for focus, a small desk preventing paper accumulation. Notably absent was a Bloomberg terminal. Its constant information flood subconsciously spurs action and wastes mental energy. I placed mine on a standing desk in my busy room, ensuring I wouldn't spend hours distracted. I now go weeks without using it, though I still pay $20,000 annually for this security blanket, acknowledging my irrationality rather than pretending to be perfectly rational. Value investing isn't just stock picking. It's a quest for meaning beyond money. Warren asked at lunch whether we'd prefer being considered the world's best lover while knowing privately we're the worst, or knowing we're the best while being considered the worst. This question struck me profoundly. How much of my life had I spent measuring myself by external validation? My family history as German Jews who lost everything to the Nazis before rebuilding in Israel shapes my conservative approach. I never use borrowed money and feel tremendous responsibility managing my family's finances. I've pursued numerous tools for inner growth: 7 years of Jungian therapy, religious study, career coaching, and mastermind groups where professionals share confidentially. The inner journey helps investors confront vulnerabilities the market inevitably exposes: arrogance, fear, greed, or need for social approval. My D.H. Blair mistake showed me I needed to address my avarice and stop measuring myself by external standards. The ultimate reward isn't just investment success, but becoming your best self, discovering that the two are inseparable. In a world measuring success by assets under management and quarterly returns, we've forgotten the most valuable investment: becoming someone worthy of our own respect. Your portfolio mirrors who you are, what you fear, and what you value. The market ruthlessly exposes every character flaw and moment of self-deception. But when you stop chasing external validation and build an inner scorecard, when you surround yourself with people better than you and create environments supporting your best thinking, financial returns often follow naturally. The question isn't whether you can pick winning stocks, it's whether you can build a winning life. Because in the end, the only metric that matters is this: do the people you want to love you actually love you? The only way to get there is to become genuinely lovable, generous, honest, and fully present. That's the real education of a value investor.